You're going to make me conceited, she replied with a grin. I'm going to blush, I know it.
My people are not happy about Bronow's pursuit of our Lady Sarai,
he told her as the Raka patrols returned to their day's work.
The Jimajen line is as corrupt as the king's.
Tell them not to fret, Ali said. Sarai's no fool. Not long after she dozed off that night, Ali saw a glowing figure walk through the soft gray curtain between her and dreams. It was Kiprioth. Although the god appeared in her mind's eye only as a glowing figure with arms and legs, she was still sure it was him.
Hello there!
His voice sounded in her ear, clear, friendly, and crisp.
Would you like to go for a short trip?
Am I going to be tired in the morning? She demanded. You know, I do work during the day.
And you shall be as fresh for it as a sea breeze, Kiprioth replied.
Look. Ali looked. There was her body, deep in slumber on her pallet. She stood on air beside the god. Very well. What kind of trip? She asked. Kiprioth put a strong, surprisingly real arm around her ghost self's waist and told her,
You'll see.
It's going to be instructive. Trust me on that. He bore her up through the keep's walls and into the open sky beyond. The ground, just touched with silver under the waning moon, raced underneath them, mountains, jungle lowlands, the sea. Lompin Isle passed into the distance behind them. Below lay the azure sea, black in the moonlight.
Why do we travel this way? She inquired, feeling confused.
You show me what's going on in Tortall through dreams.
I don't care about Tortall, replied Kiprioth. But I do love my isles, and I love to see them at night. You may as well appreciate the view. Tell me they are not beautiful.
They're lovely, Ali said and yawned. Can I go back to bed now that I've admired them? My skin gets dry if I don't get my beauty rest. Kiprioth didn't even bother to reply. He carried her over the eastern side of Imahin Isle and down the long axis of Kiprioth at a speed that would have made Ali dizzy if she had been in her body instead of dreaming. Ahead lay the lights of Rajmuat, spread over the harbor hills. The city was ablaze with light, its people milling in the streets. Kiprioth and Ali popped through the palace roof, landing inside a huge bedroom even more brightly lit than the streets. Courtiers gathered near the door, murmuring to one another. Priests of the Black God, the God of Death, stood beside a great bed at the heart of the chamber, silent, waiting. At the center of an expanse of heaped pillows, linen sheets, and goose-down comforters lay an old, emaciated man with silvery hair, black eyebrows, and stubbled cheeks. Ali had seen sketches of him in Tortall, King Orin. His lips were stained black. At his side, a healer lifted away a basin filled with blood and bile. She shook her head at the nobles who stood nearby. The man who stood nearest to the old king wore a circlet crown.
Prince Hazarin, Kiprioth said to Ali.
The healer jerked around as if she'd heard. Her eyes widened as she looked in their direction. She shivered and hurried out of the room through a small side door. Next to the prince stood a woman who also wore a circlet crown. She would be Princess Imogene, King Orin's only surviving daughter. She was beautiful in an icy, razor-sharp way. Ali looked at her for a moment, then turned her gaze to the third person there who wore the circlet, a yawning boy Elzrin's age, Prince Dunivan. Imogene held the sleepy child upright. Behind her stood a man Ali had glimpsed during her early days with the Balitongs, a tall, balding man with chill gray eyes, a thin, straight mouth, and hair that was silver on top of his head, shading to black at the ends. There was a resemblance between Rubinyan and Bronow, though Rubinyan was 15 years older. He stood behind his wife, Imogene, his calculating eyes on the king. The dying man struggled to sit up. As Prince Hazarin assisted him, the courtiers surged forward. Ali was unimpressed by Orin's oldest living son. Hazarin was in his mid-40s. At 6'1", he towered over every other man in the room, but his commanding height was offset by his bulk. He had a round face and a belly that spilled over the cloth of gold Raka sarong he wore in defiance of the Luaran court's dress code. He combed his hair straight back from his face, which accented his soft, blobby features. A small, spade-shaped beard framed his full, pouting lips.
His vices are the table and anything that he may smoke, drink, or breathe in, Kiprioth told her. He has a wife who begs him for a child, but she will get none. His loins are barren from a child's disease, contracted when he was a man. He thinks Rubinyan is the wisest man on earth, except for his taste in wives. He detests his half-sister and she him. He doesn't want to be king.
Attend all, croaked the dying Oron as Hazarin supported him in a sitting position. I hereby name my son Hazarin to be king after me.
He glared at Hazarin.
If I were you, I'd get me an heir.
Excuse me, Kiprioth said abruptly and vanished. The next moment Ali saw him again, this time inside Oran's body.
A great monarch comes,
Oran said, his voice suddenly full and commanding.
A sunrise of glory for the homeland, harbinger of new power and might in the councils of the Emerald Ocean when the fields are reaped of the invading plague.
The god left the king as easily as he'd picked him up. Oran collapsed, gasping for air. The courtiers murmured and stepped back, uncertain and afraid. Rubinyan whispered in Imogene's ear as Donivan started to cry. I love deathbed prophecies, Kiprioth confided to Ali. He'd returned to his spot beside her. They always put the cat among the pigeons. I don't suppose you'd want to confide this grand plan of yours to me, Ali asked playfully. Come on, I know you want to brag how smart you are. No one in the room seemed to be able to hear her. Tell, Kiprioth. The god shook his head.
You probably won't be here for it, he told her.
If you keep the children alive, you'll be on your way home in the fall. Besides, it's dangerous to say some things outright. Ali sighed. She didn't enjoy being left in the dark. Kiprioth patted her shoulder.
It's too serious for you, anyway, he added.
You're not letting me have fun, she retorted, pouting. The healer returned. She shooed the courtiers to their posts by the door, walked around the king's family, and made Oran more comfortable. He grabbed her arm, struggled to tell her something, but failed. Slowly, he went limp.
The king is dead, Rubinyan said as the healer drew the sheet over the dead man's face.
He turned to face Hazarin.
Long live the king!
He bowed deeply to the former prince. Imogene curtsied low. The courtiers followed them in salute to Hazarin. Kiprioth chuckled, rubbing glowing hands together. The first act ends, he told Ali as he put his arm around her waist. The next begins. Except you won't tell me what it is, Ali said as they soared through the palace roof. It'll be like leaving before the play's over. Why can't you just tell me how you want it to come out?
Because you suffer so prettily, dear,
Kiprioth informed her as they leaped into the starry night. In the morning, Ali took the goats out. She was still feeling cross that she couldn't see where the god's long game might lead him, and the Isles. Rather than visit briefly with Nawat, she nodded to him as she had done the morning before and bustled past his workbench. For a moment, his smile caught and held her attention. She dragged herself away. Every time she looked at the crow man, her lips remembered the feel of his. And she saw him so often when she was at the castle. It was too distracting. She refused to think about it. At this rate, she would become yet another girl who lingered by his bench when she was free of work. Surely she had more pride than that. That night, in her report to the Balitongs, she told them of Oran's death and Hazarin's ascension to the throne. She assumed that the god had wanted her to pass the information along.
That poor old man, Winamin said. At least he's out of his misery.
That poor old man had hundreds murdered, Wina, Dove reminded her softly.
He's out of our misery, which is more important.
But Hazarin, exclaimed Sarai, he's a disaster, and he can't have children. If he could, one of his mistresses would have given him some by now, even if his wife's barren.
She isn't, Ali said. He is. The god told me. She knew that she ought to feel bad about concealing the true identity of the god who really tampered with the Balitang's lives, but she didn't. Their ignorance was healthier for Ali. She couldn't tell how they might react if they learned that Ali knew their god was not Mithros. She didn't want to find out. The Duke and the Duchess now exchanged looks.
It's Donivan, then, and a regency council should he succeed Hazarin while still a child, Mequen remarked slowly.
Or Imogene will get herself appointed regent, Winamine pointed out. Should anything happen to the king, of course, which we pray it will not.
Should we tell the Prince King Oron is dead? Asked Dove, deliberately not looking at Sarai. With Hazarin on the throne, Pronau is back in royal favor. He'll want to leave Farajmoat right away.
Sarai gave Dove a glare that would have peeled stone.
Speaking of Pronau, young lady, Mequen said, turning to look at his oldest daughter. Sarai looked up at him.
You are a girl of sense and proper upbringing. This news about the king changes a few things.
He wants to marry me, Sarai informed her parents airily. He said so.
There were enough eavesdroppers, she glared at her sister, then at Ali, to tell you that's the truth.
But you need to keep things in mind now, said Winamine. More than the fact that he's in debt, and you are no heiress.
Sarai thrust her chin out, the image of 16-year-old stubbornness.
What sorts of things?
The Duchess sighed.
Once Pronau courted me, remember? I learned a few things about him. He is ambitious. What can the Ballytongues, disgraced, impoverished, exiled, offer an ambitious man? Seemingly nothing, except that with the king dead, your father is one step closer to the throne. Whoever marries you is one step closer. Pronau needs money, but in a pinch, a possible future queen might do, particularly if your father is no longer an obstacle. And he loves both of you.
Sarai shook her head.
He loves me. I think he does, anyway.
Daughter, love is wonderful, but Pronau need not marry for it, the Duke said gently. Countless women at court and in Rajmoat, married and not, will happily give him all the love he requires.
Without taking his eyes from Sarai, he added,
He has taken the maid Pemberi to his bed every night he has been here. Sarai's eyes blazed.
I hate you, she cried.
She threw down her hoop and fled the room.
She told me she just liked the kissing, Dove said plaintively. I thought she was playing at being in love with him, not serious.
No, but she is proud.
It hurts her pride to think he's taken someone else into his bed when he's supposed to be pining for her, said the Duchess with a sigh.
We build up pretty pictures of men when we want to be in love. We hate to have them ruined.
Now Ali could and did slip away. If Pronau didn't have ways to get court news in a hurry, she would eat her palate. He would leave them soon, which could only be to the good. 3 days later, a dust-covered messenger with a guard of royal guardsmen arrived from Demari. Word had reached the island's governor through a network of mages who communicated through scrying glasses, mirrors, and other devices. They served the crown throughout the isles, passing information far more quickly than normal methods carried it. The governor's message threw life at Tenere into a bustle, as everyone learned what, until now, only the Ballytongues, Ali, and the Ra'ka conspirators knew. Oron was dead. Hazarin would be crowned soon, and he wanted his friend Pronau at his side. By nightfall that day, the prince was ready to set out the next morning at dawn. Hasui poured the wine while Ali waited in the shadows under the main stair. She watched Sarai as the girl picked at her food. Just as Ali had expected, Sarai left halfway through supper, making excuses to her parents and Pronau as she fled the hall. Ali moved to wait by the door that led from the servant's stair to the lady's garden. As the household left the main hall after the meal, Sarai, cloaked and wearing a maid's headscarf, emerged from the keep. Without a sound, Ali followed her to the garden. Pronau was already seated on the lip of the fountain, the picture of male dejection, head down, hands clasped loosely between his knees. He jumped to his feet when he saw Sarai and crossed the ground between them in 4 broad strides, sweeping her up in his arms and kissing her fiercely. Sarai hesitated, then her arms went around Bronau's neck. She kissed him with the same passion he gave her. Ali eased into a wall niche to watch. This was better than any drama that players acted out for an audience. And this was a drama. Sarai played the desperate maiden yearning for her forbidden lover.
Bronow was the older, jaded man who had found his heart's desire when he ceased to look for it. By now, Ali was certain that the indignation Sarai had shown her parents over their assessment of Bronow's motives came more from Sarai's belief that they thought her a child than from a broken heart. At last, the man and girl separated, though they held on to one another's hands.
"I swear to you, this is temporary,"
Bronow said, his gray eyes intent on Sarai.
"I don't know if I can bear a separation, but this is our grand chance. Hazarin is my friend. He'll recall your family from this desolation, and he'll speak for me to Mequen. Then I can court you in the proper manner, not in this hide-in-the-corner way."
"Speak to Papa now," Sarai pleaded.
Bronow shook his head. "When I have only my name and little more, Mequen would be a fool to let me have you when there are wealthier men who can offer you proper estates and all that your loveliness deserves. But if Hazarin grants me the things he has always claimed will be mine when he comes to the throne, then I won't be a second son. I'll be a wealthy man in my own right. I will dress you in pearls then, and little else." He embraced her again. This time, when they stopped to breathe, Sarai told Bronow,
"You'll find some other woman at court, I know it. One who's sophisticated and rich. You'll forget all about an ignorant girl like me." "You are wrong. I will not ask for your promise now, but you will see I mean what I say," Bronow told her. "Give me some token of yours to keep near my heart."
Ali twiddled her thumbs. She tried to remember the passionate speeches that had been addressed to her. Had they been this nonsensical? Would she have swallowed them? "Perhaps when I was 12, she thought, then grinned. Being the daughter of the lioness and of a spymaster, she hadn't been romantic even then, well before she'd had extensive dealings with the people who made up her father's world. For a moment, she saw Nawat's face in her mind's eye. He would never say such things to her or to any girl. She banished Nawat's face from her thoughts and watched the lovers. Bronow was tucking the citrine drop Sarai wore as a pendant into his belt pouch. There were more kisses, more avowals of undying passion. When they heard the Duke in the distance calling Bronow, Sarai fled through the rear entrance to the garden. Ali kept to the base of the keep wall as she followed the girl. Sarai waited for her on the keep's front steps. She sat there, head propped on her hands, staring at the activity around the barracks and the torches that lit the darkness. Ali sat beside her without a word.
"I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't known you'd be there," Sarai remarked without looking at Ali.
Her lips were swollen with Bronow's kisses.
"Knowing you're watching helps me to keep my head. Otherwise, I might well end up on the grass with my skirts around my waist like those maids he tumbles."
"He seems very passionate," Ali said idly, running her fingers through her cap of hair. Sarai sighed.
"He kisses so much better than the boys in Rajmuat."
"Do you want to marry him?" Ali wanted to know.
"I'm not sure," Sarai frowned. "I daydream about it, but it is just a dream. Papa and Winamin aren't sure of him. That has to weigh with me."
"They're his friends. They ought to know," Ali pointed out.
"Well, he's leaving tomorrow. I won't have to worry about it for a while," Sarai remarked and sighed. "Maybe I'll see if that handsome Nawat has decided to be interested in me yet. He's only a commoner, and an odd one at that. But it might be fun, teaching him how to kiss."
Ali scowled as the other girl stood and went inside. She wasn't sure that Sarai ought to practice kissing on someone who might not realize it was just a form of amusement. Worse, what if Nawat fell in love with Sarai? Ali knew that Sarai was very much aware of her position as a noble. She would flirt and have fun, but when her father reminded her of her duty to her family, Sarai would do it. She would marry for the betterment of her family. Ali decided Nawat had to be warned. She told herself that she didn't want that innocent heart of his broken by a noble beauty trying her wings. Ali refused to admit that she had any personal reason to warn him. It occurred to her briefly that she had been much like Sarai back at home, flirting with boys and men just because she was bored and liked kisses. The thought was not a comfortable one. No one expects a woman busy at her sewing to pay attention to what's being said around her.
never mind if a man's mother and sisters showed them they heard everything while they stitched, he'll still think a woman who plies her needle saves all her brains for the work. You're a far better spy hemming sheets than if you clank with daggers.
From A Letter to Ali from Her Father When She Was 14. Chapter 12. The Mage of Pohan. Ali rose at her usual hour the next day, but instead of immediately leaving with her goats, she waited. When Bronow's party rode out, she collected her herd and followed. She had resigned herself to the fact that the men were likely taking secret communications with them. These were not merchants who could be frightened by hooded warriors. Ali didn't worry about any report Veron might smuggle out with Bronow's company. With a new king on the throne, the royal agents throughout the Isles would await instructions from their masters before they made any reports that might offend the new government. Ali tracked the prince and his group to the road out of Tenere, watching them until even their dust was gone. She silently wished them a dangerous voyage and death at sea, then took her goats on to graze. When Ali and the goats reached Eket and Vijda, she found that Nawat, Ulasim, and Janai waited there along with the shepherds. Ulasim was already riding a horse, while Janai held the reins for three mounts, including the mare Cinnamon.
"Did you sigh over the last of his horse's droppings?" Ulasim wanted to know, smirking. "You watched him go for long enough."
"Ali doesn't like him," Nawat pointed out. "Ali thinks he will come back and try to eat the nestlings." Ali grinned at the crow man and looked at the two Raka.
"So lovely of you to pay a call," she told them. "I wish you'd sent your messenger ahead so I might have prepared refreshments."
"You will have your jokes," replied Ulasim.
He looked like a bronze Raka idol in the saddle.
"Mount up. We go to Pohan. My mother has agreed to meet us. That is, you. It's going to be a long morning."
Janai revealed the thinnest scrap of a smile, the first sign of any emotion Ali had ever seen on her face.
"You have no idea how long," she said.
Ali raised an eyebrow at her bodyguard.
"Your grandmother's that charming, is she?"
"Come see for yourself," Ulasim said.
He looked at Nawat, who was idly picking insects from a tree's bark and eating them.
"Your presence will not help. I told you so back at Tenere."
Nawat bird shrugged.
"Mages do not worry me."
Ali clumsily mounted Cinnamon.
"There is no need to keep doing that," Ulasim told her wearily. "Lokage says you can ride well."
"Then keep that to yourselves," Ali retorted. "It suits me that our associates not be aware of all my skills." To Nawat she said, "You were scarred by a mage once. Shouldn't that make you wary?" He cracked a beetle between his teeth.
"It was the Pohan mage who did it," he said. "She makes funny noises when her sheets are in the mud."
He looked up at Ali.
"The red ants are spicy. Would you like one?"
He offered her an ant with his normal, cheerful smile, but the look in his eyes was that of the human male she'd seen the night he had kissed her. Horrified, Ali realized she was blushing. She never blushed.
"I thank you, no," she replied, turning Cinnamon.
To the two Raka, she said.
"Let's go then. Vijda, Eket, I'm sorry, but the goats..."
"We are ready,"
Vijda said with a grin.
"Have fun with the mage."
Ali followed Ulasim and Janai to the road.
"This mage," she asked the Raka, "she's decided she will join you?"
Ulasim snorted. Today he dressed as a Raka in a homespun wraparound jacket, embroidered in dark colors and a Highland Raka's leggings. His long hair was tied back in a horsetail.
"She has only said she will talk to you, and I wouldn't put it beyond her to change her mind. Do you know how annoying it is that you can do that?"
he asked Nawat, who trotted along next to them, his bare feet scarcely making a sound on the dirt road.
"I am running."
Nawat's voice was as relaxed as if he sat on his workbench, fletching arrows.
"It's not as good as flying, but it is exercise."
"Yes, but does he bother you?"
Ali asked the two Raka.
To Nawat, she explained, "I don't want to make any Raka uncomfortable, you see, and maybe you would."
"We are cousins," said both Nawat and Janai. They halted and stared at one another. Both looked startled and pleased. Finally, Janai said,
"Everyone knows what he was, and crows and Raka are both the children of the crow god and goddess.
Our legend says the first humans were hatched out of the great crow nest. We made a mistake in the egg and shed our feathers.
Then there have been other crows who turned into people?
Asked Ali. She couldn't help but think that someone could have mentioned that earlier.
Rarely, said Ulasim. But there are tales, just as there are tales of those Rakka who turn to crows rather than die. Do we stand here all day, or do we get on with things?
He sent his horse down the road. Ali and Junai followed, Nawat trotting along between the two women. Am I no longer the goat herd? Ali wanted to know.
Her grace says you need to be able to move, replied Ulasim. Our ladies wish to ride far and meet their people. Her grace wishes to spend more time at the castle, minding the younger children and preparing the household for winter. You are to bear Sarayu and Dovasari company, with their bodyguards and Junai.
Ali nodded. That would work. As always, she was grateful to the Duchess for seeing what was necessary.
Now this mage is your mother? She asked. Junai's grandmother, Ochubu?
She hates Luaran, replied Junai as her father's face went stony. She has agreed to talk, not to help.
That will be a matter for your persuasion, unless you intend to have the guard command her.
If I were you, I would call on the guard,
Ulasim informed Ali dryly.
She is sworn to him. She must obey. You? We will be lucky if she does not scorch you. But you insisted on seeing her, and she is a powerful mage, powerful enough to guard this entire plateau.
Ali drew herself up in the saddle, miffed. She was the daughter of George Cooper and the Lioness, after all. It was a pretty sad thing if she had to depend on a guard to step in whenever a little diplomacy would do the trick. Have we brought presents for her? Sometimes a properly offered gift appeases even the most stubborn people.
It would not appease her, Ulasim replied, grim-faced. She is a cross-grained, bitter, cruel old hermit.
She says the sweetest things of you, too, said Junai. I think you are both too proud to apologize, father. To Ali, she said,
He's right about a gift, though. Grandmother would only make it explode in your hands.
Here, said Nawat, reaching a hand to Ali. She might like this. He passed her something hard. Ali looked at the thing he'd given her. It was a rock, some kind of granite, bright and sparkling in the sun.
Nawat, she asked wearily, why have you given me a stone?
It is sparkly, Nawat informed her gravely. Females like sparkly things, just as crows do. Junai made a noise that sounded very like a snort to Ali. Ali sighed. She ought to have known that his reason didn't make sense to her in the least. Not human females, Nawat.
That's not exactly true,
Ulasim told her in a choked voice that sounded as if he was trying not to laugh.
Rubies, emeralds, diamonds, all of those things sparkle, and human females love gems.
Ali shot the footman a look that said, Don't confuse him. She tucked the rock into her belt purse. I'll explain later, she told Nawat, who watched her with worried eyes.
Thank you for trying to help me.
When they rode around the walls that encircled Pohan, Ali relaxed. She was not sure the villagers had forgotten her last visit. Instead, Ulasim and Junai led her and Nawat deeper into the forest, following a narrow road. They passed into the lands behind the village, riding under tall, ancient trees alive with birds and squirrels. It was a perfect summer day, not too hot, even on the open road, with gentle breezes carrying the scents of pine and leaves to Ali's nose. At last they reached the top of a ridge that looked down into a small, cup-like hollow. At its bottom was a rough log house, hung about with charms, signs, and wind chimes. A creek raced past it, shaped with stone by human hands to form a deep pool before it re-entered the trees. A line of drying clothes hung in the sunshine behind the house, a homely touch for a mage's domain. A pair of cats lounged in front of the door, watching them with eyes turned amber by the sun. Nawat grinned.
It's washing day, he observed.
Ali frowned at him. Leave the wash alone. You're not a crow anymore.
No, he replied. I am a mateless human.
He sighed, trying to look forlorn.
Stop that, Ali warned.
She kneaded cinnamon down the path toward the cottage. Halting in front, she and her companions dismounted.
A tiny creature flew over to sniff Ali. She sighed in wonder. It was a miniature flying horse, a bay mare, bat-winged and perfect, its body no larger than her hand. "Where did you come from?" she asked softly.
"They nest here," replied Ulasim as other winged horses flapped around them.
A piebald stallion glided over to Nawat.
"The old woman puts up with any nonsense if it doesn't come from a human being," the Ra'ka continued bitterly. "Sometimes I think..."
He was interrupted by the piebald stallion. The tiny creature reared and neighed, pawing the air in fury.
"Maybe he remembers me," Nawat remarked.
The stallion flew at him, hitting him in the face with his wings.
"Stop it! My mother had nestlings of her own to feed."
"You took one of their nestlings?" asked Ali, horrified.
"Several," replied Nawat, trying to shield his face. Two more winged horses flew in to attack him. "They make a very... ouch! Good meal for hungry young." "Why did you come if you made an enemy of the little Kudarung?"
Ulasim wanted to know. He and Janai backed off, leading their mounts away from the small winged creatures.
"Is there anyone hereabouts who likes you?"
Nawat yelped as four more winged horses swooped at him from a clump of bushes where they seemed to gather. Ali giggled as they dove at him, kicking, biting, pulling his hair and clothes, smacking him with their wings.
"I thought they wouldn't remember," he cried in answer to Ulasim. "It's been weeks and I was a crow."
Ali dismounted and handed her reins to Janai, then ran laughing to Nawat's rescue.
"Stop that,"
she ordered as more of the small winged horses swarmed out of the brush. "He isn't a crow anymore." She gently tried to bat them away from Nawat.
"How did you even recognize him? He's not here to take nestlings."
She grabbed the piebald stallion as he tried to nip at Nawat's face.
"He's quite a reformed... ow!"
The tiny stallion twisted in her grip and fastened his teeth in one of her fingers, drawing blood. Ali dropped him. The stallion flew at her face. Ali squeaked and ducked. More of the winged horses appeared in answer to their fellows' enraged calls. Half of them descended on Ali, the rest on Nawat.
"I think they believe you are a crow, too," Junai called as the still-amused Ali protected her head with her hands.
The creatures bit her hands and gouged her head with hooves and teeth, battering her with their wings.
"Will you help us instead of gawping?" demanded Ali, trying not to laugh.
She didn't want to hurt the tiny immortals, but their assaults were painful, and she had business here. She could hardly impress Ochebu Dodeka if she was too busy fighting off winged pests with long memories.
"But it's the most amusing thing I've seen all year," Ulasim replied in a strangled voice.
Speaking appeared to destroy his control. He collapsed in laughter. Janai simply watched, a tiny smile on her usually still face. Ali flapped her open hands, trying to push the small Kudarung away. Nawat covered his head with his arms.
"They're clever, aren't they?" he asked Ali, wincing. "To know I'm a crow, even in this shape."
"I don't care how clever they are," Ali replied.
She yelped as a Kudarung bit the rim of her ear. Grabbing the animal, she tried to tug it free, but it refused to let go. Not wanting to hurt it or tear her ear, she had one course of action left to her. She ran for the stream and dove into the part that had been shaped to form a deep pool. The water coming from the mountains was bone-achingly cold, even on this summer day. She lunged to the surface and gasped, her teeth chattering. Water sprayed all over her as Nawat jumped in, shedding Kudarung as they saw where he was bound. Ali swam to the edge of the pool. She was about to climb out onto the land when a small flock of Kudarung attacked, driving her underwater. She found Nawat there, forced under the surface as she had been to escape their tormentors. They shot up for a deep breath of air before the immortals descended. On her next trip for air, Ali looked around quickly. There on the bank, near the shallow upper stream, she saw a likely weapon. She ducked underwater and swam toward it, her head aching from the chill and the Kudarung's assault. When she came up again, the large branch was a yard away. She lunged and seized it, wading into the shallow water above the pool. There she stood, batting her persecutors away with the branch. Nawat joined her to huddle at her side.
"They are not very forgiving," he observed.
Ali lifted a foot and shoved him back into the pool. Above the shrill, furious calls of the Kudarung, she heard laughter as harsh as any crow's bawl. She turned to find its source and saw an old woman barely 5 feet tall. The newcomer was dressed like the Highland Ra'ka women, in a bright wraparound jacket and long skirt, both thickly embroidered. The fire of a magical gift shone from beneath her skin in Ali's sight. The old woman had a long nose, eyes like upside-down crescents framed by wrinkled flesh, and a mouth as straight as Junai's. White locks combed to either side sprang from her hairline at the center of her forehead. The rest of her short, curling hair was the color of steel shot with threads of black and white. Her laughter had a jeering quality.
"Ochabu Dodeka, is this how you treat your guests?"
Ali demanded, swinging her branch at the Kuda room.
"We're here to talk to you. Call these things off before I hurt one."
"I don't want to talk to you,"
the old woman replied with a grin that showed teeth.
"And they aren't pets to come and go at my command."
She looked at Junai and Ulasim.
"This is the god's messenger?"
she demanded, her black eyes snapping with scorn.
"If you are listening to this Luar and Sisat, you haven't a prayer of success. I won't go with you to die."
Ali sighed. It was time to work. She handed the branch to Nawat, who was climbing out of the pool. When he took it, Ali went to Ochabu. The Kudurum, who had concentrated on swarming Ali, turned to continue their attack on Nawat.
"Am I mistaken?"
Ali inquired mildly, leaning her head to clear water from one ear.
"You're refusing to help us."
"If they are helped by such as you, they are beyond hope," retorted the old Rakha.
"They would do better to take the road as roaming players amusing the Luar and nobility."
Ali leaned her head to the other side to clear the water from that ear. In her politest tone, she inquired,
"So you must approve the work roster before you will deign to help.
Must the ones who risk their lives among the Luaran every day bring each and every tool they choose for your inspection first?"
Ochabu scowled at Ali. "No one asked you."
Ali dug in her ear with a finger.
"Your god asked me, Ochabu Dodeka," she replied, still polite, knowing that the old woman expected her to show rage. "And do you know what? It will be for nothing," she informed the Rakha with her friendliest smile.
"Because as long as you and others like you find only obstacles, you can put off actually having to do something. You can just talk about it and dream of someday. We'll all die of old age. You, Rakha, will still have the Luaran boot on your necks. After a while, Rakha won't mean people anymore. It will just mean slave."
"I could blast you where you stand," Ochabu whispered, her eyes deadly.
Ali wrung out her tunic's hem. "Go on," she said cheerily. "Do your worst. Of course, the god might object." She gave Ochabu a moment to think, and then another moment to act. When it was clear the Rakha mage was not going to kill her, Ali called, "Nawat, stop playing with the little horsies. We're going back to Tener."
"I would gladly stop playing with them," Nawat called, swinging his branch around him to keep the Kudurung at bay. "They are the ones who will not stop."
Ochabu looked over Ali's shoulder, pushing her lips in and out as if she were thinking. Ali concentrated on wringing out as much of her tunic as she could reach. Finally, Ochabu bared her teeth and whistled sharply. A handful of Kudurung flew away from the swarm. The old woman whistled twice more before the rest broke off their assault and returned to their clump of brush. Ochabu looked at Ulasim and Junai.
"Did the pesky crow have to come?" she demanded.
Ali smiled graciously. "I like the crow." The old woman looked at Ali, then at Nawat.
"Stay away from my drying lines," she warned.
Nawat treated her to his beaming smile.
"I am a man now. Men do not drag cloth in the mud."
The mage snorted, then looked Ali over.
"Were you any other god's messenger, I wouldn't believe you,"
she said dryly as Ulasim and Junai led the horses across the creek.
"But our god would pick a Luaran."
"You choose tools for a task by their crafting, not their look,"
a crow said crisply from a nearby tree. He flapped over to land on a barrel in front of the cottage.
"A smith's finest hammer will be streaked with soot."
Like the Kiprioth crow of Ali's first Isles dream, he wore gem-studded rings on his talons and a gaudy jeweled necklace around his throat. He shone in Ali's sight.
"So you really chose this wench,"
Ochabu said. Kiprioth ruffled his feathers. "Stop trying to quarrel with me, or I will leave you to the Rajmuat Luaran. Do you think Oran was bad?"
He will be as nothing compared to Hazarin, Imogen, Rubinyan, and Bronow, believe me. If we're to change things, it must be now. The chain's time has come. Ali frowned.
What's the chain? She asked.
Kiprioth turned a ring on one claw with his beak. It was Ulasim who answered.
My mother and her friends, he said, meeting the old woman's eyes with defiance. A network of Ra-Ka mages spread throughout the isles waiting to take back what was theirs.
You said it might not be so, Ochabo remarked wearily to Kiprioth. You said we might fail.
Every human effort has that chance, replied Kiprioth. We gods can't change that. Besides, it would be very bad for your characters if you had things easy all the time.
I told my children that. They didn't believe me any more than I believe you.
Ochabu walked over to a bench next to her door and sat between the cats.
We wouldn't be in this state if you had turned the invaders away 300 years back.
Kiprioth leaped off the barrel in crow form and landed on the ground as a man in his human jewelry, jacket, and sarong. He stood before Ochabu, sparks in his dark eyes. Ali took a step back, feeling his presence as a pressure on her body and mind like a heatless sun. Ulasim and Janai shaded their eyes as they looked on. Only Nawat seemed unconcerned. He squatted on the ground, dripping, as he ate selections from a column of ants.
You do not think gods may be routed from their thrones and thrust into the outer parts of the divine realms?
Kiprioth asked Ochabu softly.
You do not believe a god may be so battered in combat with his land-hungry brother and sister that he might need centuries to heal? Do not speak of what I should have done, Ochabu Dodeka. You were not at my side on that battlefield.
Ali wished she could go anywhere else. This was too personal for her. For the first time, she felt like a true intruder in the Copper Isles. This was the reason he toyed with her and the Balitongs, this ancient loss. Kiprioth's playfulness had made the stakes seem small, as if he had meddled with her life for his own amusement. Now she had the truth of it, that the tide was turning in the Copper Isles. She was a pawn, the Balitong children just one more piece on a board that stretched over miles and years. Ochabu slid down to kneel before Kiprioth, tears streaming down her face. She had borne even more of the god's power than had Ali, Ulasim, or Junai. Ali rested a hand on the old woman's shoulder.
Maybe she snaps at you because she's afraid, she told Kiprioth, though she didn't quite dare to look into his face. You gods know you have centuries to turn the tables. We humans don't. We have short lives that can be made shorter with the stroke of a sword.
Burning fingers gripped her chin, forcing her to look up. Ali jerked away from the painful touch. When Kiprioth grabbed her chin a second time, it didn't hurt. Her knees quivered as she met his bottomless gaze, but somehow she managed to remain on her feet.
Dear heart, you are wasted in Tortal, Kiprioth told her softly, his eyes showing her suns and waves that swamped islands, volcanoes, and shivering cracks in the earth.
One of us would have put a fire like yours to use sooner or later. He let Ali go and regarded Ochabu.
Old woman, let's have a cup of tea, for old time's sake.
Ali helped Ochabu to stand, but she didn't go with Kiprioth and Ulasim when they followed the woman inside. She stayed in the sun, drying out with Nawat as Junai unsaddled and groomed the horses. It took a while for her head to stop spinning from that long look into the god's eyes. A flicker of light at the cottage's open doorway told Ali that the god had left. Ulasim and his mother remained inside for a while longer, talking. Janai and Ali practiced their combat exercises, and Nawat tried to catch fish bare-handed in the stream. At last Ulasim left the cottage, saddlebags hung over one shoulder. He and Janai got to work saddling their horses and the sway-backed mare that ambled out of the shelter of the trees when Ulasim left the house. Ochabu finally emerged, carrying a pack. She thrust it into Ali's hands, then walked over to the clump of brush where the tiny kudurung nested.
Nawat, put that down, Ali told her friend who had secured a wriggling fish. We're leaving.
But I just caught it, Nawat complained. I knew I could.
You still know you can. Let the poor fish go, Ali retorted. With all the bugs you've eaten today, you can't possibly be hungry.
She heard a sound and turned, frowning, to see what was the matter with Janai.
Her usually stoic bodyguard was actually trying not to giggle.
If you only knew how strange that sounds, Ulasim remarked. You sound like her mother.
He nodded at the red-faced Junai. Nawat sighed and released his captive back into the stream. Ali shook her head and strapped Ochobu's pack to the back of Cinnamon's saddle. Well, he has been eating a lot of bugs, she said, knowing that didn't explain anything. Ochobu returned and mounted the sway-backed mare. Three adult Kudurung flew in her wake, all of them pitch black with white stars on their muzzles.
They make good messengers for short distances, Ochobu told Ali, and if you or the crow bothers them, you can carry your own messages.
Ali rubbed her sore ear and winced. She had bumped the deepest bite. Holding her much-smeared handkerchief to the wound, she said, I never bothered them in the first place.
I will not bother them if Ali says not to, added Nawat.
To her he whispered, not until we have enough nestlings of our own to mob them back. We're not going to... Ali began in a heated whisper, trying to deny that they would mate and have nestlings, but realized it was useless. This was just one of those ideas Nawat would have to outgrow, since words didn't seem to change his mind on the subject.
Let's go, Ulasim ordered. There is work to be done at home.
They rode together out of the hollow and back down the road. When they reached the fork that led to Pohan, Ochobu reined up.
Junai, ride in and let Pilya know I'm gone, she ordered. Ask her if she will keep an eye on things and feed my animals.
I cannot, Junai replied. She pointed to Ali. She is my charge.
The old woman glared at her granddaughter.
You think I cannot protect your Luaran pry monkey? Sorry, grandmother, Junai said quickly.
She kicked her gelding into a trot and headed for Pohan. Ali watched in awe, then turned to Ochobu.
Will you teach me how to do that? She asked. She never listens to me.
I will not, said Ochobu, following Ulasim down the road.
Converse with me only when you must, Luaran. I may have to treat with you, but we will not be friends.
Ali shrugged and let mother and son ride far enough ahead for them not to suspect she was eavesdropping. Ochobu might never like her, that was plain. So long as they could work together until the equinox, Ali didn't care if Ochobu liked her or not. The old woman had every reason to hate white skins, after all. At least I don't have to share a small castle with her over the winter, she thought happily. She watched as Nawat ran into the woods a little way to examine something that had caught his eye. He would return when he felt the need. It occurred to Ali that in her eagerness to get any kind of true mage to Tener, she had never asked anyone what kind of power Ochobu had. Obviously the old woman was strong, to stop bandits from preying on the villages of the plateau, and protective magic was certainly the most important thing for the Balitongs to have. Still, Ali could put Ochobu to better use if she knew the mage's strengths. Ali let her mind drift, absorbing forest sounds. Songbirds, rustling creatures, squirrel disputes, Nawat steps among tree litter. In the distance, a crow family discussed the location of a dead animal supper. An eagle's distant shriek reached her ears and the whisper of wind in the pines. She closed her eyes, adjusted her mind to bring into play the more complex aspects of her magical sight, then opened them. Ochobu's gift had been visible from the moment Ali first saw her. Gifts always appeared in her vision as a series of ripples in the air around the mage, as if he or she gave off heat. Now Ali's deeper sight discovered more specific powers that appeared as images that glowed, then faded over the round curve of Ochobu's back. She saw a mortar and pestle, a handful of plants, a storm racing over the open fields of the plateau, a charm that turned away harmful magics, a bowl of water for scrying.
Stop that!
Ochobu called over her shoulder, startling Ali out of her calm state.
It tickles.
When they got back to Tener, Ali had a quick talk with the Duchess about the morning's events.
So you're saying we have a mage now, Winamine said when Ali was done. And we need to make her part of the household without raising a fuss.
Ali bowed. Exactly, my lady. Winamine stared into the distance for a moment, her lips moving as she thought. At last she looked at Ali.
Rihani's never been comfortable as our soul healer.
She is a wonderful herb wife, but has little experience with serious ailments. I think she'll be relieved if this Ochobu takes over, and she can be of use in making medicines. I also know my woman, Pemberi, is less than delighted with looking after Elsrin and Patran during the day. Rihanni may take her place, and Pemberi shall wait on Sarai and me. And you, my dear, are being promoted again. It is time Dove had her own maid. Ali grinned. I serve at your grace's command, she replied, thinking that the Duchess would have made a fine general, with her delicate way of rearranging her troops. From what Ali knew of the household, everyone whose job had just changed would like the new arrangement. The change for Ali herself meant that she was now free to ride anywhere that Dove might choose to go. Once the Duchess met Ochabu and explained things to Rihanni and Pemberi, Rihanni took Ochabu to the keep's infirmary. Ali helped the footmen to move the Duke's and Duchess's things back to their old rooms, now that Bronau was gone. After the adult Balitongs were resettled and the older girls' rooms restored for their use, Sarai took charge of Ali's wardrobe. Dove ordered a hot bath for her new maid. "Because you should look nice and not shed goat hair on my things," she said primly, her eyes dancing with mischief. Ali stuck her tongue out at her young mistress and happily climbed into the tub. The main thing she had missed about home, after her family, was the luxury of a real bath. After weeks of washing in ponds or from a basin full of water, a hot bath was bliss. Ali soaked until the water began to cool. She washed her scant inches of red-gold hair twice, scrubbed until she was crimson with cleanliness, then dried herself with a proper cloth. She noticed that she had put on some weight with the Balitongs, but the meals of leftovers, bread, and cheese had still not brought her to the weight she had at home. "Try these," Sarai ordered, opening the dressing-room door and tossing in gowns and shifts. "Can you sew?" "I can sew," she told Sarai, thinking, "Da made sure of that. Of course I require the usual tools for it." "Use my box," Sarai offered. "Dove replaced her sewing things with ink and pens and paper. You'll need to take these clothes in. You're too big for Dove's hand-me-downs and too bony for mine." She grinned at Ali and closed the door. Ali spent the rest of the afternoon stitching Sarai's cast-offs to fit her thinner frame. Once she had a complete outfit, a cotton shift and an amber-colored gown, she dressed and hurried downstairs in time to pour the supper wine. Afterward, she joined the family in the Duke and Duchess's chambers, Sarai's sewing box balanced on her hip. There she sat and sewed, a perfectly natural evening's occupation for a lady's maid. Once Rihanni took Elsrin and Patran up to bed, the family shifted in their seats to look at Ali.
"I thought you objected to promotion," remarked the Duke. "You told us that people would notice a servant being somewhere that she shouldn't."
"I've kept my goatherd's things just in case," Ali said. "For now, acting as Lady Dove's maid will take me to the places I need to go as long as I continue to wear my collar." There was a rap on the door. Without waiting, Ochabu came in and closed the door behind her, sealing it with a line of magical fire visible only to Ali.
"To foil eavesdroppers," the old woman explained gruffly.
She nodded abruptly to the Balitongs, then took a seat, uninvited. Ali sighed internally at the old woman's pride, then told the Duke, "Your Grace, this is Ochabu Dodeka of Pohan Village. She is the mother of Ulasim and a true mage. Ochabu, I present His Grace Duke Mequin Balitong." Ali glared at the old woman until she bowed to the Duke from her seat. "Her Grace has already made Ochabu's acquaintance," Ali continued. "Ochabu, may I also present Lady Sarayu and Lady Dovasari." The old woman looked the girls over with sharp eyes. Then she bowed, but to that she added the Ra-Ka gesture of respect, her arms crossed over her breasts, palms on the opposite shoulders. The girls, startled, responded with the same gesture. To the Duke, Ali said, "Ochabu is sent by the god to help to protect you." She crossed her fingers behind her back, praying that no one here would mention which god was involved. She had forgotten to tell Ochabu that the Balitongs believed it was Mithros who had taken an interest in their fate. "When Ali said she'd found a true healer and herb wife, I nearly collapsed with relief," the Duchess told the Duke with a smile. "Rihanni is good with herbs and lesser ailments, but I've been living in fear that someone would break a leg or some great sickness would reach us. We would be in real trouble." To Ochabu she said, "You are thrice welcome among us."
"I could do no less, lady," Ochabu replied stiffly.
I serve the family of the First Duchess, and it is my honor to serve her daughters.
I would like to learn from you if it's agreeable, Winamine said. Unless you prefer not to have someone underfoot. I know many healers don't. Rihanna will assist you, of course, but I think the more I can learn, the more useful I will be.
Ali couldn't decipher the look that Ochebu gave Winamine. Finally, the old woman said, Most Luaren do not ask. They order.
We are not of that sort, Mequin replied, his deep voice quiet. In this house, the Raka are respected, as my first wife was respected.
Winamine was also Sarugani's friend.
We can gather herbs when we go out riding, like we did for Rihanna, Sarai told Ochebu. If we know what to look for, we will.
Riding? Asked the Duke, raising his brows.
Are you not needed here? Lessons getting our house in order for winter?
We have summer chores well covered, said the Duchess. The girls feel they didn't really get to know the local people on their rides with Bronow.
Everything was formal and country matters bore him.
I'd like to stay home with the little ones. I feel I've been neglecting them.
When Mequen still frowned, the Duchess touched his arm. My dear, the girls will have plenty of time for lessons once winter starts. The villagers say we may be confined to the castle for days at a time. Let them ride now, while they can.
Mequen took Winamine's hand within his.
Very well. He looked at the girls. Behave and obey your guards, or you will be confined to the castle grounds until spring. Do you understand?
We are not in Rajmuat any longer. Trouble can find us here easily.
Yes, Papa, said Dove meekly.
Yes, Papa, echoed Sarai. Ali glanced at Ochebu. The old mage watched the Duke, her eyes and face unreadable.
Still, thought Ali, she isn't cursing or spitting on the floor because he and the Duchess are Luaren. It's a start.
In a time of fear, the one who I promised will come to the Ra-Ka, bearing glory in her train and justice in her hand. She will restore the god to his proper temple and his children to her right hand. She will be twice royal, wise and beloved, a living emblem of truth to her people. She will be attended by a wise one, the cunning one, the strong one, the warrior, and the crows. She will give a home to all, and the Kudarung will fly in her honor. From the Kiprish Prophecy, written in the year 200 HE, discovered in Duke Mequin's books by Ali.
Chapter 13 Ladies of the Ra-Ka. The next morning, after Pemberi and Ali helped them to dress and make up their room, Sarai and Dove took Ali to breakfast, then to the stable. They passed Nawat, seated in the sun as was his habit, carefully gluing feathers to shafts. Ali stopped for a moment, fascinated with Nawat's fine touch as he set the fletchings in glue. Sarai returned and dragged her away. Lokage's stable boys had already saddled Sarai's gelding, Dove's mare, and Ali's mare Cinnamon. Fezgau, two of the other men-at-arms, and Junai were already mounted, waiting for them. Ali clambered as awkwardly as she could into the saddle and made a small business of wriggling to settle herself. Their party rode through Tener at a walk. Many of the people who were out wanted to greet the two Balitang girls personally. Ali was careful to sit her mount like a sack of flour, keeping up the pretense that she rode badly. Once they were clear of Tener's gate, Sarai cried, "Let's go!" and kicked her gelding into a gallop. Fezgau and one of the men-at-arms followed her, catching up before she was too far ahead. Dove did not even twitch her mare's rein for a faster gait. Ali, Junai, and the other man-at-arms stayed with her.
"I thought she just did that to show off for Bronow," Ali commented.
"No," Dove told her and sighed heavily. "Every summer when we go to our mountain estates in Tongkang, she gallops everywhere. She loves to ride. I think she'd do anything in the saddle if she could, including sleep."
"That talent could be useful," Ali pointed out.
"Wait till your behind starts to hurt, then tell me if it's useful," advised the younger girl. "I really admire Wina. All those rides with Bronow, and never once did she let on she's got saddle sores."
"She wants Sarai to like her that much?" Ali was surprised. She knew that the Duchess wanted her stepdaughter's affection, but she hadn't guessed how far the lady might go for it.
Well, a little, Dove admitted. They get on well enough anymore. Mostly Weena came for Bronow.